Welcome back to our Sunday school class of Encounters with Jesus, and welcome and thank you for all those who participated in the class and have given me feedback. I appreciate that. But what we're looking at is various episodes in the Gospel of Mark and how people react to Christ and listen to Christ and hear him. And this section, we've just talked about Jesus sending out the disciples on this unique preparatory mission where they preach repentance and heal the sick and cast out demons. This is a boot camp kind of season of their ministry, a trial run for preparing them for when Jesus will not be there. Jesus is expanding, replicating, reproducing his ministry through his disciples. And that has brought increased notoriety to the disciples as well as to Jesus. And so Mark follows that story with the story of John the Baptist's death, his martyrdom, as John embodies the potential cost of following Jesus. We're going to read a lengthy section now of Mark chapter 6, beginning with verse 14. King Herod heard of it, for Jesus' name had become known. Some said John the Baptist has been raised from the dead. That is why these miraculous powers are at work in him. But others said he is Elijah, and others said he is a prophet like one of the prophets of old. But when Herod heard of it, he said, John, whom I beheaded, has been raised. For it was Herod who had sent and seized John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because he had married her. For John had been saying to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. And Herodias had a grudge against him and wanted to put him to death, but she could not, for Herod feared John, knowing that he was a righteous and holy man, and he kept him safe. When he heard him, he was greatly perplexed, and yet he heard him gladly. But an opportunity came when Herod on his birthday gave a banquet for his nobles and military commanders and the leading men of Galilee. For when Herodias' daughter came in and danced, she pleased Herod and his guests. And the king said to the girl, ask me for whatever you wish, and I will give it to you. And he vowed to her, whatever you ask me, I will give you up to half of my kingdom. And she went out and said to her mother, for what should I ask? And she said, the head of John the Baptist. And she came in immediately with haste to the king and asked, saying, I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter. And the king was exceedingly sorry, but because of his oaths and his guests, he did not want to break his word to her. And immediately the king sent an executioner with orders to bring John's head. He went and beheaded him in the prison and brought his head on a platter and gave it to the girl, and the girl gave it to her mother. When his disciples heard of it, they came and took his body and laid it in a tomb. Well, there are some disturbing statistics that we see in the news, basically communicating that the number of people in the United States who are calling themselves Christians, that number of people is shrinking. And every so often, some news organization will, I suspect, gleefully report that there's been a decline in American Christianity. In 2015, for example, a Pew Research poll showed that the Christian share of the American population declined almost 8 percentage points from 2007 to 2014. More and more people are identifying as religiously unaffiliated, the so-called nuns. They just have no desire to be in any kind of religious camp whatsoever. Now, we ask, is this cause for alarm? Some would say yes, others would say no. But there is a positive way to look at these statistics, a less pessimistic way, because the headlines can be misleading, that it's a little bit premature to write the obituary for American Christianity. Perhaps it's important to redefine what we mean by American Christianity. What's really happening is that nominal Christianity, which is kind of a cultural Christianity, we see it here in the South. It maintains the outward trappings of Christianity, maybe the traditions or nostalgia, the aesthetics of Christianity, maybe the conservative politics or the conservative theology that go along with Christianity. But at a heart level, it affirms none of its core convictions. Maybe that nominal Christianity is in decline. And I think we even see it now with the midst of this pandemic, where many churches are shut down, and people who maybe have only gone to church once or twice a month or just have walked away from the church. Ed Stetzer, who's a leading voice in American evangelicalism, says American Christianity isn't collapsing, it's being clarified. And we would say that's a good thing. Nominal Christians are giving up the pretense of faith, while convictional Christians remain committed. A younger millennial voice, Brett McCracken, says that there has been a healthy pruning away of mutant and neutered forms of Christianity. Those kinds of cultural or nominal versions of Christianity that become inconvenient to maintain when they're no longer fashionable. Russell Moore says a Christianity that reflects its culture, whether that culture is Smith College or NASCAR, only lasts as long as it is useful to its host. That's because it's at root idolatry, and people turn from their idols when they stop sending rain, when they stop bringing power or success or prosperity. Christianity is not going to be your golden ticket to the white picket fence American dream. It's an invitation to die, to take up your cross. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German theologian, summarized the Christian life in one sentence: when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. Very starkly stated there. He bids him come and die. Christians are those who give themselves away in love and sacrifice to advance a kingdom that is not of this world. C.S. Lewis says, I didn't go to religion to make me happy. I always knew a bottle of port would do that. If you want a religion to make you feel really comfortable, I certainly do not recommend Christianity. So here's a story of John the Baptist, probably one of the most choice servants of the Lord to ever walk the planet. And here he is paying the ultimate price for following Jesus. Jesus said in Matthew 11:11, truly I say to you, among those born of women, there has arisen no one greater than John the Baptist. Following Jesus involves a cost. And we see that nowhere more clear than in the story of John the Baptist. In Mark's gospel, this is one of the rare stories where Jesus is no longer, he's not at the center stage. John the Baptist and his interaction with Herod, that's what takes center stage, but it's all under the umbrella of how Jesus is cultivating and training and commissioning his disciples. Here's what happens when you follow Christ. Here is the potential of what might happen if you follow Jesus. And we see Herod's reaction here to John's denunciation of his adulterous marriage to Herodias. It's a lesson in contrasts. So first we're going to see Herod's conscience, how it is pricked by John's righteous life, and how he feels guilty and ashamed, and then the scandal that that has led him to this negative interaction with John the Baptist, and then finally his downfall. So let's first of all look at his conscience. So Jesus sends out the 12. The scope of Jesus' ministry and influence is expanding as he replicates his ministry through his disciples. And that results in greater notoriety, more public exposure, and that comes to the attention of Herod, who is the current Roman ruler in Palestine. Now, if you've ever read the New Testament, you say, how do I keep all of these Herods straight? There are roughly 4 different Herods mentioned in the New Testament. Now, who is this Herod? And I'm going to give you a brief, maybe 60-second explanation of who this Herod is. This is Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas. Again, there are 4 different kings in the New Testament, all bearing the name Herod. There was Herod the Great. He's the king that we meet in the opening chapters of Matthew's Gospel, who was responsible for the murders of all of those little children in Bethlehem. And one of his sons was this Herod, Herod Antipas, who ruled after him for 43 years, ruling in Galilee for most of Jesus' ministry and earthly life. So Herod Antipas, he's called a king. He's not technically a king in Galilee in the official sense of the word. He's known as the Tetrarch of Galilee. So he's a deputy ruler of the Roman Empire, sharing the responsibilities of leadership with others. So he was king in the popular sense. He spent years completing his father's project of building the temple in Jerusalem. The wall known today as the Wailing Wall is the remnant of that temple of Herod's. But Herod Antipas was not a nice person. He's not someone we would want to hang out with. He was shrewd, immoral, ambitious. He loved luxury and wealth. He was self-important, proud, grandiose. Jesus referred to Herod Antipas as that fox, a reference to his cunning, to his ruthlessness. And Jesus would later stand before him on trial. We read that in Luke chapter 23. So Jesus, news of Jesus' notoriety and his spreading popularity, his surging popularity, reaches Herod, and there's all sorts of speculation in the follows about Christ's identity. Who is this Jesus that I'm hearing about? Some think in the public arena that Jesus is the revived John the Baptist. That was Herod Antipas' personal belief. Now, it's part superstition. Maybe he thinks John is some kind of ghost that's come back from the dead to taunt him for Herod murdering him, putting him to death. Now, why would Herod think Jesus is John raised from the dead? Because he had a guilty conscience. He had a guilty conscience. The ministry of Jesus reminded him of John the Baptist's ministry, the power that John the Baptist had when he preached, the righteous character that John displayed before people of power, people of influence. Now, John the Baptist never performed any miracles like Jesus did, but the power of God rested upon him. He spoke the unvarnished truth without any fear of reprisal. And he rebuked Herod for his sin. And so Herod sees the same kind of righteous, holy life in Jesus. He thinks this is John the Baptist revived. Now, some people think Jesus is Elijah. Elijah caught up in the heaven in a fiery chariot, never actually dying. So there was widespread belief in Judaism that Elijah would return at the end of time. And contrary to popular speculation about Jesus being Elijah, Jesus himself describes John the Baptist as having come in the spirit and power of Elijah. Some people think Jesus is a prophet. He was like one of the prophets of old, an idea that emerged from Deuteronomy 18:15, predicting a prophet that would come in the spirit of Moses and the power of Moses. So what are we seeing here in the speculation from Herod and from the general population is that Herod's conscience has been pricked. He says, John, whom I beheaded, has been raised. Maybe he's afraid. He's paranoid. Does he think John the Baptist has come back from the dead to haunt him? Why is he so concerned? Why is his conscience so burdened and guilty? Well, because Herod Antipas had committed this great scandalous sin, and John the Baptist called him out on it. So his conscience feels guilty, and we then read about the scandal that led to all of this, that led eventually to John the Baptist's martyrdom. Verse 17, it was Herod who had sent and seized John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because he had married her. For John had been saying to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. So what Mark does here is he takes us on a flashback. You know, you see this in movies where the screen gets all blurry and you go back in time, or you go to some other event in history. And that's what Mark is doing here. We're going back to events that have transpired before this. Herod's encounter with Jesus here is triggering his memory of previous events. We're told in Mark chapter 1, verse 14, that John had already been imprisoned as Jesus began his ministry. Here we're told John was in prison for the sake of Herodias. Now, this is another twisted part of the story. See if you can follow this with me. This is the stuff of daytime soap operas, As Palestine Turns, so to speak. This is one twisted family tree. So who is Herodias? Herodias is Herod Antipas' current wife. Herodias was formerly married to Herod Antipas' half-brother, Philip, Herod Philip. Herodias was actually Herod Antipas' sister-in-law and his niece, if you can keep that straight. So at some point, Herod Antipas had returned to Rome with all of its decadence, with all of its lust, and he'd been given a respite from the backwater, sweltering land of Palestine, and he fraternized with Herodias, become infatuated with her. He didn't think the rules applied to him, and so he had dismissed his wife. Herod Antipas had dismissed his wife and then married Herodias. How could something that felt so right be wrong, he tells himself. And this was a scandalous sin. And John the Baptist was a faithful preacher of the word, and he did not take opinion polls before preaching his sermons. He did not tickle itching ears. He spoke the unvarnished truth. And John had publicly charged Herod Antipas, a very risky thing, had charged him with breaking God's moral law. Verse 18, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife, is what John the Baptist is preaching to Herod Antipas. So even though King Herod was not a Jew, he was still accountable to God's moral law. So Leviticus 18 condemned his marriage to Herodias as adulterous and incestuous, and Herod had effectively married his niece. So John was unafraid to speak the truth to the politically powerful, and he told Herod to his face, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife, like the prophet Nathan to David. You are the man. During the time of the 16th century Scottish Reformation, John Knox's ministry of preaching and prayer were so well known to the Roman Catholic Queen Mary, Queen of Scots, that she reportedly said, "I fear the prayers of John Knox more than all the assembled armies of Europe." Knox was a man of great courage. One man standing before Knox's open grave said, "Here lies a man who neither flattered nor feared any flesh." So John's preaching the unvarnished truth, enraged Herod Antipas's new wife, Herodias, infuriated her. We're told in John in verse 19, she had a grudge against John. She wanted him put to death. As one person said, Herodias felt that the only place where her marriage certificate could safely be written was on the back of the death warrant of John the Baptist. So verse 20 says, Herod feared John, knowing that he was a righteous and holy man, and he kept him safe. And when he heard him preach, he was greatly perplexed, and yet he heard him gladly. You know, there's parallels here between John the Baptist and Elijah. They're legitimate parallels. You know, for one, John condemned Herod Antipas and Herodias by implication for their immorality. Elijah confronted another angry queen, Queen Jezebel. Both angry queens tried to destroy God's prophet. Jezebel tried to destroy Elijah, and Herodias tried to kill John the Baptist. Both stories involving an inappropriate marriage. Ahab's marriage to Jezebel led to Baal worship. Herod's remarriage to his brother Philip's wife, Herodias, was seen as a violation of the Old Testament moral law. Both involved a weak, vacillating king who feared the prophet, but would gladly listen to him. So Ahab feared Elijah, but would hear him. Herod Antipas feared John the Baptist, but would gladly hear him. So here, the righteous have a way of terrifying the wicked with their godly conduct. And that's what often happens. You either try to destroy the righteous, silence them, so that you are no longer convicted in your conscience, so you don't have to listen to them any longer. That's Herodias' preferred path. Or you are perplexed by the righteous conduct. You like the fact that there's somebody who is speaking the unvarnished truth. Herod was somehow moved by John's preaching. He enjoyed listening to him. He knew that John had nothing to lose. And so unlike Herod's many courtiers who flattered him and told him what he wanted to hear, John told Herod the unvarnished truth. So he knew that when he stood in the presence of John the Baptist, that he was hearing truth from God. And maybe this was the first real courageous man that John the Baptist had ever, or that Herod had ever met. And so he was torn. He admired John because perhaps this is what Herod thought. This is the kind of man I need to be. And then he's also torn between his forbidden, lustful desire for Herodias. The historian Josephus tells us that John was executed in a place called Machaerus on the hills surrounding the Dead Sea. So there Herod the Great had erected one of his palace fortresses, strongly defended with high towers to spot any invading army, but also containing a lot of luxury and apartments and so forth, like Saddam Hussein had in Iraq. And Josephus describes Machaerus as a magnificently spacious and beautiful place with apartments and wealth, but deep under the palace there were these dungeons, and they can still be seen today with their iron hooks. Maybe John was bound to one of those hooks, and there's no amenities, no heat, no plumbing, no light, and so every so often Herod might come down to the dungeon, and the soldiers would throw a bucket of water on John and clean him up a bit, and he would preach before Herod and tell him where he was wrong. So Herod's protection of John could only last so long because Herod had a weakness, and his wife, his current wife Herodias, was an angry, jilted queen who hated John, and she knew that Herod had a weakness and that he would cave under pressure. So that was the scandal, this immoral relationship that he was involved in, this adulterous relationship. So his conscience is smitten, he feels guilty because of this scandal, and then we see his downfall, Herod's downfall. Herodias finally gets her opportunity, seizes the opportunity to do away with John the Baptist. Herod Antipas throws a birthday party for himself, extravagant, excessive, invites all of his friends. This is the who's who of society, the upper crust, the political, the social, the military elite, anyone who's anyone is at this party. And this was a men-only event. And we're told that Herodias' daughter, the text doesn't name her daughter, but Josephus calls her Salome, that she has to go outside to ask Herodias for guidance because she was not invited into the party. This was a frat party, a bacchanalian event, which is like an immoral feast named for the Roman festival of Bacchus, celebrating with dancing and song and revelry. Just a heaping cauldron of lust. And right in the middle of it all is Herod Antipas. Weak, immoral, indulgent, vulnerable Herod, about to be set up by the evil, conniving Herodias. We're told in verse 22 that Herodias' daughter came in and danced. She pleased Herod and his guests. So Salome, she's probably in her mid-teens, maybe 15 or 16. So you can imagine a room filled with old, squinty men, overheated with lust as this young woman dances for them, a very erotic dance, fitting well with the infamous decadence of the Herodians. And after the dance, the king says to the girl, wanting to impress his guests, just ask me forever, whatever you want, and I will give it to you. It's an utterly foolish move on Herod's part, opening himself up, doing it publicly so that he can't take it back, so that he would risk great embarrassment if he retracts his oath. Up to half of my kingdom, this extravagant, not a literal promise, but just a, hey, listen, I've got all of this stuff at my disposal, and I will give you whatever you want, because I'm the king and I can grant it. So full of self-importance is he. So much does he want to impress his friends. But Herodias has ensnared him, caught him in his trap, used his own lust his own decadence to catch him. Because Salome exits the room and she asks her mother for advice. And Herodias' patience finally pays off. Her hate can be avenged. Take off the head of John the Baptist. Salome, you see, is complicit. She embellishes it just a little. Her mom says, take off his head. She says, take off his head and bring it back on a platter. So as mom goes, so goes the daughter. She's just as evil, has those same wicked impulses. And Herod, who's most likely intoxicated when he makes this offer to Salome, sobers up very quickly, because it would be a horrific loss of face for him to back down at this point. An embarrassment in front of his friends that have come for his birthday party. And so he has to follow through on the promise. And Herod is revealed to be a spineless, immoral, weak, vacillating, pathetic ruler who takes the easy way out rather than standing up for what is right. He knows that John the Baptist speaks the truth. He knows that John the Baptist is innocent. But for the sake of his own reputation, he must follow through. And Herod dispatches the executioner to behead John. It's a violent ending to a noble life, one of the finest people to walk the planet. Jesus saying he's one of the greatest people to live. Here is John, the solitary, faithful preacher, dying an ignoble death, unjustly imprisoned, dying violently. These were the consummate fruits of his labor, which tells us something about being a disciple of Christ, that in the world's eyes, your work, your labor, a lifetime of labor may appear fruitless at the end, but in God's eyes, you may be the greatest person who's ever walked the planet. Stephen and James, others in the New Testament, of whom the world is not worthy, to use the language of Hebrews, he was called to seal his testimony of faith with his own blood. John the Baptist is the forerunner. Jesus is the Messiah. Both of these men spoke truth to those in power and influence. Both were put to death by self-seeking rulers who know their victims are innocent but vacillate under pressure and choose expediency over justice. And after John's death, rumors arise that he has risen from the dead. And Herod is filled with all kinds of fear and paranoia, his conscience smitten by his guilt and by the scandal of his sin. But who is the one who actually does rise from the dead? It is Jesus. So this story calls us to count the costs. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. Whether it's true or not, it seems to be true that American nominal Christianity is collapsing. That could be a good thing, because committed Christians have to clarify their convictions. Nominal Christianity is collapsing, but true Christianity is being clarified. Pressure will be brought to bear upon us, perhaps financial pressure, social ostracism. Will we stand with Christ? Will our commitment remain firm to Christ? True believers will remain committed even when the truth is unfashionable.